for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Tigers are disappearing from the earth at an alarming rate. Fewer than 3,000 remain in the wild. So far, conservation efforts have largely failed to save the big cat. New approaches focus more on scientific study of existing tiger populations and working with governments to crack down on illegal hunting. Joining me in the studio to talk about what can be done to save tigers from extinction, Alan Rabinowitz of Panthera, Carolina Alexander. She's contributing writer for National Geographic magazine, and Herb Raphael of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Please join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. And good morning to all of you. Caroline, I'll start with you. Going back to the 1900s, how many tigers were there then? How many tigers do we see in existence now that we are aware of?
Every article one will read about the status of tigers always begins with this figure that there were 100,000 tigers estimated 100 years ago. And I frankly have become very impatient with that figure because it serves absolutely no useful purpose. We are so far removed from ever being able to realize the landscape that existed at that time or the numbers that existed at that time, that the number survives now as just a kind of haunting relic of something that happened in a faraway place and time. The number of tigers in the wild today are estimated between, I'll quote the articles we ran in the National Geographic story, 3,500 to 4,300. However, even that figure, which our fact checkers at the magazine diligently searched, really errs tremendously on the side of, on an optimistic side. That was taking at face value some figures that had been assembled by different governments and NGOs. I think most people working in the field today would say that there are approximately 3,000 tigers in the wild today.
Alan Rabinowitz, how did we get to this point from back there, however optimistic it was then or now?
Well, we got there by not having our eye on the ball, really. But there was, back at a certain point, there wasn't really any reason to need our eye on the ball. There appeared to be tigers in all available habitat. Seem to be good numbers, but that's always a very dangerous thing because we always realize that there are too few when it's far, far too late. What happened with tigers, which was a much greater threat than with the other large cats, all the big cats are endangered to a certain point, but tigers by far are the most endangered with the fewest numbers. Lions are second, then come jaguars, but tigers are in horrific shape. The reason for this has to do with the economics. They're valuable. Tigers dead are much more valuable to local people than alive. And it's tied into the Asian medicinal trade. It's tied into many other factors, primarily the medicinal trade. And the trade in tiger parts, tiger skin, is very, very great. So tigers have been killed in the last several hundred years. Tigers have been killed always, but the killing of them has accelerated, and as they get more rare, they're even more valuable, and it's accelerated even more.
And to you, Herb Raphael, if you were put on the spot and had to explain why it is tigers are valuable, why do we need tigers?
Yes, well, you know, being an ecologist, a lot of the conservation community, myself, we tend to argue that we need tigers because they're a flagship species. They play an essential role in an ecosystem that an ecosystem without tigers has all kinds of fallout effects. That said, I don't take that argument. I don't buy that argument, despite the fact that I'm an ecologist. I would argue we need tigers mainly because it's sort of like saying, well, why not fill the Grand Canyon with water and make it into a dam and create hydroelectricity? We need tigers because tigers are one of the absolute most critical impact species as far as our own cultural values as people. You know, we get excited about extinct animals like Tyrannosaurus rex. Well, today, animals like the tiger are modern-day Tyrannosaurus rex, and they're a cultural value for the world, and that's why we should care about them.
But I gather, Alan Rabinowitz, you feel that our approach to dealing with this declining number of tigers has been off on the wrong tangent.
Well, our approach, it's not that it's necessarily been off on the wrong tangent, but it's been a shotgun type of approach. It's been doing a lot of different things, all of which can be claimed as good. How could you say that educating children about tigers in a local school in China is not a good thing? It is a good thing, but it's not saving tigers. At this particular point in time, tigers are in the emergency room. Tigers are bleeding out. There are less that we know exactly where the last tigers remain, probably less than 50 sites around the world where there's breeding populations of tigers. When there's a patient in critical care, the last thing that you do is worry about extraneous things, is worry about that patient's home life, worry about what might be happening in other parts of his body. You focus on where that patient is bleeding out and stop the bleeding. My strongest point today in the conservation field is that we have to focus our resources on stopping the bleeding, and that means law enforcement. That means making sure that there's abundant prey for tigers. People are not killing tigers. People are not killing tigers' prey, and people are not taking away the last of their habitats. That's the blood that's flowing out.
Herb, do you agree, disagree?
Well, I can't disagree with Alan in terms of us stopping the bleeding. There's no question about that. When somebody's in the emergency room, we need to do that. That being said, we have to look at why they're in the emergency room. And if there's only one person in the emergency room, that's a lot different than ambulances pulling up every day with more and more people, and we simply can't handle them. And I think that's my concern. And that is that, yes, it's an emergency, and it's been an emergency for some time, but it's an emergency that, as far as I can see, is only going to increase if we focus only on emergency room treatment, because we're not addressing why people are in the ambulances coming here.
Caroline, how do you see it?
Well, I think that the part of the problem with conservation is that the timeline has speeded up so quickly, exponentially. So strategies that were begun under one set of conditions, a very different economic climate in China, for example, now there's a lot of money around for people to purchase valuable tiger parts and wares. This has happened relatively recently, and time is relentlessly seems to be speeding up. So I believe that the luxury of this more multifaceted approach, which is absolutely essential to long-term survival of the animals, which are the, Alan might say, the peripheral aspects of tiger conservation, were devised at a time when time wasn't moving so quickly. So,
Alan, what would you like to see happen?
The primary thing I would like to see happen is the people involved in tiger conservation and the donors who give money to tiger conservation get on the same page in how we have to focus our efforts properly. While I agree with virtually everything Herb says, what I don't agree with is that When somebody comes into the emergency room, the doctor does not say or should not say, how did this person get here? Who shot this person and why did they shoot this person? Why did this person grow up poor and end up in the emergency room? Those are absolutely factors you're going to want to get at when you get that person out of danger or cure that person or stop the bleeding.
How would you get the tigers out of danger?
Okay,
now?
Well, we do know how to do that. The good thing, the optimism I have is that we know how to save tigers. We absolutely know how to save tigers.
How?
And when you say there's one primary factor. You have to have better law enforcement. Yes, you're working against political will in certain countries, but I've never been to any country where the government has said, no, you can't help us save tigers. They've said, we don't have enough money. It's not a priority. But if you bring the funding, if you show us how to do it, we will do it. The law enforcement is not adequate. We don't think our law enforcement in cities like New York or Washington is adequate, and there are tens of thousands of more law enforcement people per person than there are for the tigers. If we truly value tigers, we've got to step up to the plate in terms of what it really takes to be enforcing the law that people cannot kill tigers or hunting in these last tiger areas for the tigers' food. If that's done, tigers come back very, very well. Tigers breed very well. Once we do that, once we lock up some of their key breeding areas, absolutely we should be looking at other things.
Alan Rabinowitz, he's the author of Life in the Valley of Death, The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed. We'll take just a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk further and take your calls. That, of course, is the sound of a tiger recorded by National Geographic. We're talking in this hour about efforts to save the tiger, which the species of which has diminished now to about 3,000. Here in the studio, Herb Raphael, he's chief in the Division of International Conservation for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Caroline Alexander, she's author and contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. We do have her article on our website, so if you go to drshow.org, you can get the link to that article. And Alan Rabinowitz, he's a zoologist, wildlife ecologist, chief executive officer of Panthera, that's a wildcat conservation group, and the author of Life in the Valley of Death, The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed. That sound is just extraordinary. What does that sound say to you, Alan Rabinowitz?
When I hear tigers vocalize, it says a lot of, it goes right to my core. It's just a cry. It's, tigers want to survive. They will do anything to survive, no matter how difficult we try to make the situation be for them. And when I hear them vocalize, as I did when I was a child standing at the Bronx Zoo watching them behind the cages of the Great Cat House, it evokes the same incredible feeling of strength and sadness and captivity and just give me space, give me freedom, and I will do okay. Just leave me alone and I'll do okay. That's what that sound always brings out in my mind.
And, of course, at the time, as a young boy, you were a stutterer, and being at zoos somehow helped you a lot.
Well, I'm still a stutterer. I just have learned how to control it a lot better. I was a severe stutterer as a child, and my father knew that when times were hard for me in school, he would take me to the Great Cat House at the Bronx Zoo, and I would stand in front of two enclosures, either the tiger or the jaguar, and these huge, powerful beasts making those calls, which you just heard, and vocalizing in their concrete cages, this power trapped inside a cage, just wanting to be free, evoked in me the way I felt as a child inside of my own head. And I was able to talk to animals and not stutter very much while I could not speak to people. So I grew up in my childhood feeling much closer to animals than I do to people, which is still true today.
How long did it take you as a young boy feeling closer to these animals, dealing with the inability to speak to humans? How long did it ultimately take you to get to open up to people as well?
I'm not sure I've ever completely opened up to humans the way I've opened up to animals. I'm not sure I want to. But I didn't learn how to properly speak, how to actually use tools to speak the way I'm speaking now until I was a senior in college.
I see.
Only then would I start trying to deal in the human world. And it was a dream come true for me because that allowed me to fulfill a promise which I never knew if I could fulfill, which was I would try to be a voice for animals. Because I do realize, and I think it's very true if people realize it, that part of how we mistreat animals has to do a lot with the fact that they don't have a human voice.
And Caroline, how did you first become interested in the tigers, the big cats?
Well, the story specifically came, the National Geographic magazine had been pitched the story by Steve Winters, the photographer whose pictures appear in it, and who's one of the elite big cat photographers in the world.
Gorgeous photos.
Gorgeous photos, and very troubling also. And I believe I was asked to do this story by the magazine because I had written previously about tigers in the Indian Sundarbans for the New Yorker magazine. That's a swampy mangrove area with very unusual tiger population. I was also haunted by the challenge as a communicator, if you will, of writing about extinction. I had some years previously been involved with a film about the ivory-billed woodpecker, of all things, which was made in association with National Geographic Feature Films. And the challenge of trying to convey the potency of absence is unlike anything else I can think
the
of.
The potency of absence, which we cannot feel.
Which we cannot feel. And so with the tigers, this problem I saw was that I can actually remember, I'm old enough to be able to remember when the bell of alarm was first rung for them in the 1970s. And it seemed impossible I was, like many people, had a kind of lazy passion, if you will, for cats. I loved them, but I didn't think much about it, or I took them for granted. And it seemed that tigers would always exist somewhere in forests safe across the seas. And you might not see them, but they were there, and their cry was there, and you imagined the forests resonating with that kind of call. And suddenly to be told it wasn't so was quite stunning. And I feel we've lived with that knowledge now for so long that the edge of urgency has been taken off. And so the question is, how do you now convey to people that this is no longer just a rare animal, that they have been threatened for a very long time, the threat was real, but now the threat is perilously real? And so the intent was to galvanize people to feel this urgency as opposed to just intellectually understand it.
And before we get to what people can do, Herb Raphael, I don't understand what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is doing being involved with tigers, since, as far as I know, there are no tigers here in the United States.
Yes, well, that's true, except the Fish and Wildlife Service, though it's a domestic agency in a lot of ways, has international mandates. So, for example, the Endangered Species Act refers not just to endangered species in the United States, but endangered species around the world, and we regularly list species that are in other countries. That said, there are a number of laws that Congress has passed recognizing that the American public cares more and more about species outside the United States, that they have passed laws, one of which is the Rhino and Tiger Conservation Act, specifically for the conservation of those animals in their native habitats.
So how do you react to Alan's criticism that indeed there needs to be more law enforcement to protect these animals from extinction?
No, absolutely. Alan's absolutely right there. We can't have too much law enforcement. It is an emergency, and we need to have people at every site that has tigers. If it is not properly controlled, they end up being poached practically everywhere. So that's a reality, and that's something we all have to help address.
Practically everywhere, but the demand for tigers is greatest where, Alan?
Well, the demand for tigers is greatest in China. That's the country that's operating as kind of the vacuum cleaner, sucking up tigers from all throughout tiger range. Tigers are being bled from all the range countries. The country with the most tigers, who's doing some of the best enforcement at the current time, is in India. At some places, enforcement is not going well. But many of the other range states are at perilously low numbers for tigers. And they're all feeding into this mostly a Chinese wildlife trade market, a medicinal market for tiger parts. And one of the misconceptions that many people in the West have is that most of the demand has something to do with sexual potency, and that isn't true. The Chinese medicine is not a primitive thing. It's something that goes back over 5,000 years. Many of our modern Western drugs are based on Chinese medicine. Chinese medicine is a very powerful form of medicine, and it's used worldwide, and there's a lot of efficacy in many of the products. Tiger bone and tiger parts do not have any efficacy. It's been tested. It's been tested in Beijing and Shanghai.
So you're saying it's all mythology going back thousands of years.
It is mythological, but that's just that doesn't at all help with the tiger, because that's an important part of Chinese medicine. So even though it's partly folklore and mythology, that's a powerful part of that Chinese medicine component also.
Well, you've got placebos in this country, which continue to be efficacious in some areas. And if the belief is there in this tiger as medicinal medicinally effective, there you are, Caroline.
It's important to point out that Chinese traditional medicine has, as it is sort of formally recognized by a board of practitioners, has repudiated the use of tiger parts since 1994. So in official straight-up Chinese traditional medical practitioners would not endorse the use of tiger parts. The market is fed by persistent traditional folk beliefs, but I think we should not be shy about saying that, that this is not about Chinese traditional medicine, which is respectable. This is about counteracting a lingering folk superstition.
So is there any way that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, for example, can counteract this kind of continuing folklore and the demand for these tiger parts?
Yes, there is. And I think, you know, first starting with Alan's point, which is you have to deal with the emergencies, and there's no question about that. We accept that entirely. It is these values and beliefs that are the crux of the problem. And we should look at the values and beliefs from two sides. One is in China, where you've got beliefs having a very negative effect on tigers. And then we also have to look, though, in the other countries, such as India, where it is folklore and beliefs that make tigers and all living things part of a web of life. And so we're losing those values. I'm more concerned about losing those values in India than I'm about changing values in China. They both have to happen. But what's happening right now is values and beliefs that are either a great threat to tigers in China, or where they have, in fact, they are the main cause of the survival of tiger in countries like India and probably Myanmar and other countries. We have to keep those values alive.
Herb Raphael of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about keeping those values alive, Alan Rabinowitz?
Well, I'm sympathetic with the idea, but my overwhelming task in life is to keep tigers alive. If in the process of keeping tigers alive, some of the cultural traditions have to be changed, then they've done that in the past. Nobody questions the fact that in Borneo, tribal groups were forced no longer to be able to take heads, which was a very, very important part of cultural beliefs, head hunting. As it was a rite of passage. It was a rite of manhood. We stopped that because that was not in the best interest of the people.
Human head.
Yes, human heads. We are losing traditions and cultures in this world which shouldn't be, which we should fight to be keeping alive. But anything relating to the killing of tigers or the killing of tigers' prey has to be stopped. That just has to be stopped. I will not buy into arguments that, well, people have to still be allowed to be hunting these animals which the tiger feeds on in the tiger's own protected area or in their last homes because that's been their traditional way of life. Well, I'm sorry. It's a different world, and things have to change if we believe that tigers are still to survive.
Caroline, what do tigers prey on?
Tigers prey on wild pig, chital, which is a form of deer. If they're lucky, bigger things like muntjac and gaur, which are sort of exotic big deer and oxen-type animals. And they need a lot of meat. And part of the main problem with tiger numbers declining is that, as Alan says, tigers are being killed. The other problem is that poaching of prey animals is also a problem. We speak of poachers, and some of those are for the tiger trade market, and some is for local hunting and meat. If one's a local hunter, there's several things. It looked at dispassionately. That's that might be what that particular person has always known how to do. But once those prey animals are also poached out, the hunter suffers as well as the prey. In other words, what happens when the hunter comes to the end of the line and has nothing else to hunt? So a change has to be made, even if this were looked at in purely human terms, which is there isn't enough prey to go around for hunters to keep alive their long tradition of hunting.
To what extent are tigers hunted because they are attacking humans? Caroline.
That would be a very small, very, very small percent. The numbers are always troubling because they're human casualties. I happen to have previously been in this area, the Sundarbans in India, where the man-tiger interface is more dangerous than I think anywhere else in tiger range countries or reserves. But this happens usually when a tiger has strayed into a village. It's not a general problem.
Caroline Alexander, she's an author and contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. We'll take a short break and open the phones when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael C. Hall, the star of the Showtime series Dexter, about a serial killer who kills other serial killers. A tricky role for an actor, because the character is always pretending to have authentic emotions.
In a way, it was liberating to let go of that preoccupation. Does this feel right? Does this feel authentic? Am I telling the truth here?
Join us.
And one of the questions I have before we open the phones, how do we count tigers? How do we know how many are there, Herb?
Well, the mechanisms for that have changed through the years, but the real advance now is what they call camera traps. And so camera traps are set up in areas where tigers, like many other animals, follow paths and routes, and one of the good things, so to in some ways, is that they often follow roads through the forest rather than beat their way through. And so camera traps are set up strategically, and there's a whole science to it at this point. And now there are some parks and protected areas that have a huge, basically are covered by camera traps, so we're able to photograph the animals at night without human disturbance.
I would think all these areas are extraordinarily dark, Caroline.
One of the most remarkable places I think I've ever been was for this story, and this was a place in northern Myanmar or Burma known as the Hukong Valley. And for people with knowledge of World War II would know that this was one of the arenas of one of the great air campaigns with U.S. Cargo planes flying over the Himalayan hump, as it was called, and often crashing into this forest. And to give you a sense of the scale and density and darkness of the forest in this valley, I can tell you that there are still hundreds of cargo planes in that forest that have never been found.
Oh my.
So this is extremely difficult. This is a forest big enough to have swallowed planes. And somehow in this, these wildlife forestry officers have to go on foot on lengthy foot patrols and set up, even setting up cameras means somebody has to go into the ground to do it. And it's become a high art of a lot of it's to do with very sophisticated statistical models as to where you set these traps best and how you survey and how you patrol. But I think the thing I carried away most vividly from this trip, apart from seeing an actual tiger, was the sense of the formidable task of just having to navigate this terrain.
And, Alan, how often are tigers collared with tracking devices?
We do radio collar tigers. It's become more difficult to do politically, frankly, in most tiger range countries, because while many of the governments seem to not care as much that so many tigers are killed illegally, they care a lot more if a scientist ends up capturing one and putting something on it. But having said that, we do, in certain countries, capture them, drug them, put a radio collar on them. It's now the technology has changed from the early days when I was doing that on jaguars and tigers, to where we use satellite collars or GPS collars, meaning that we can be getting data constantly from these collars. And they are breakaway collars. They will fall off eventually,
see.
Which is wonderful. So it's not like that stays on for the life of the animal. And we get data from that of the animal's movements. And most importantly, the data we want more than any is the dispersal. Where do these tigers move to? Because that, in many ways, helps tell us what to conserve. Not only where these tigers are, but the young males, as they're going and finding new areas, where do they need to go to? Corridors. So that's very, very crucial data we're getting.
All right. We'll open the phones first to Battle Creek, Michigan. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. I was wondering if maybe putting a small hunt together for some of the tigers would help alleviate some of the pressure for the black market prices and maybe make it not as profitable for the poachers to hunt. And I'll take my answer off the air.
What do you mean a small hunt? I'm not sure I understand that, Jason.
Well, maybe like 1 or 2% of the tiger population, so that then you're not decimating the population, but you're taking some of them out to alleviate some of the pressure from the poachers.
Caroline.
I think that's an extraordinarily perverse suggestion. The numbers are so small that, first of all, taking 1%, 2%, 3% is almost incredible. More to the point, there have been sort of these outlets that in theory are supposed to be taking the pressure off hunting the populations. For example, in China, there are 5,000 captive tigers being held in these quasi-zoos, but which also serve or threaten to serve as kind of tiger parts farms. The idea being that if you can supply the market with farmed tiger parts, it will take the pressure off the wild tigers. And putting aside all sort of squeamishness about that concept on its own terms, it isn't effective, because as long as there is any market for the tiger parts, there to provide substitute tiger parts through hunting, through farming, is still to feed the market. And the only way to kill the market is to make it absolutely, is to just take it off the books, that you cannot use tiger parts, you cannot trade them, and this should be treated like the high crime it is, same way we treat drugs or arms trade, which is shares many of the characteristics of illegal wildlife trade.
All right, to Ken in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I am really concerned. I mean, this is a topic that I've actually witnessed firsthand when I was in Thailand in the early 90s with the Navy, and we took a tour of some different places in Bangkok, temples and things. And one of the things that I was just, my jaw was just open the whole time I was there was these tigers being raised by pigs with golden retrievers there as well for whatever reason. And then so as we went through this tour of this place, it was really sad because you knew, like, where are all these animals going? And I was just appalled to think that, you know, we were talking with other people that were there, like, what are you doing with these animals? What's happening? And they wouldn't really answer it. And I just, hearing this, you know, topic today really, you know, gets to my heart because it's like, what's happening to these animals? Nobody would answer that, you know, when we were there on the tour.
So how did you find out what was happening?
Well, you could tell that there were no older animals. There were no older golden retrievers. They were all puppies. All of a sudden, it's like we go through, you know, we see where they're born, where they mate with the female pigs, and then they're raised together. You know, the pigs, the piglets, the cubs, and the I don't know if tigers are called cubs, but and then the puppies are raised together, and then all of a sudden they're in different areas. The, you know, dogs are together with themselves and the tigers and so on. And then you go through the tour again and you go further and then they show.
So what you're saying is that you believe they were being raised for their meat.
Absolutely. And then hearing the topics about what the tigers are used for, you know, in China and other countries, then it just makes sense to me. Why is there not a ban on this kind of thing? Because the tigers are being raised for that purpose.
Yeah.
That's a very good question. I was in Thailand in the 1990s also working in a place called Hoi Kha King on the Thai-Burmese border, a place which fortunately now is one of the best tiger areas we've got throughout Tiger Range. At that time and up until the present day, which is shocking to me, there were these tiger temples. I think that's one of the things that you're referring to, the most famous temple being at a place called Kanchanaburi, the famous tiger temple, and I believe that's the one which is shown in the National Geographic article. These temples have gotten more popular instead of less. They bring in huge amounts of tourists who are allowed to play with the tigers, sit with the tigers. The tigers are defanged and declawed, usually, and you don't see old tigers there. And I've gone back numerous times purposefully identifying the tigers by their stripes because the monks would claim these are the same tigers. And I put a lie to that statement. They were not the same tigers. There was a large turnover in those tigers because I could identify them in a way that the monks didn't realize we had the ability to do. Many of these temples, I can't say all of them, but they are feeding into a market trade. They're making money on tourists. They are doing nothing. And these are monks and Buddhist temples. And frankly, it's an abomination. And why doesn't the government do anything about it? Because it's a religious institution, the way we would view a religious institution.
So how do you re-educate people? Herb, you've had radio soap operas, for example, going. Tell us about those.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the big challenges. The radio soap operas are a perfect example. We don't use radio nearly as that much in this country anymore, but in many parts of the developing world, it's, well, we do. I know we're on radio now, absolutely.
I hope
that's right.
So.
It's just that, it's funny, I was just watching a show recently and they were talking about putting 55-inch television sets over people's barbecue pits. So that was what's on my mind. But yes, that said, it's much more popular in the developing world. And so the question is, how do you reach out to people to get them to change their attitudes and their behaviors about these things? And radio soap operas is one of the tools that we found incredibly powerful.
Give me an example. How does that work?
Well, it's just like a television soap opera here, except it has an environmental theme. And the environmental, it's integrated into the soap opera, not just as an entertaining, you know, love triangle type thing, but rather has elements specifically related to conservation. And that could be the conservation of tigers. It could be this issue of using them, you know, their medicinal use, and is that real or is it not real? And if these soap operas are done in such a way that people really identify with the primary characters, they take home messages about how they treat one another, how they treat nature, how they treat tigers, how they treat other wildlife.
And how effective do you think that is, Alan?
I think it is effective. The radio in many tiger range countries is the primary medium. The way we would immediately say TV in this country, in many other countries where they don't have it in the rural areas, it is radio. I think these radio shows, what the Fish and Wildlife and Herb have funded, are really good programs. But you will always find me, and I don't think those should be stopped. But I have to keep on coming back to the fact that we have to focus our efforts on stopping the bleeding of what is killing tigers right now immediately. I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing anything else, but we're so short of funding for doing what the most critical threats are that we need most of the effort and the funds to be going on mitigating those critical threats to stopping the bleeding.
How many countries have outlawed the killing of tigers? Caroline?
It's illegal. It's illegal
anywhere in the world.
Right. And it's illegal everywhere in the world.
So
in China,
it's the poachers.
It's illegal crime. And this is why the term law enforcement is appropriate. These countries in their own laws, own terms, have outlawed the killing of one of their natural assets.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Mitesh, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to say it's an honor to be on the show. I've been listening for a long time, but this is the first time I'm actually calling in. I hail from Nairobi, Kenya. That's where I was born and raised, and this is an issue that's animal conservation. Animal conservationism, despite, you know, being tigers, rhinos, lions, leopards, cheetahs, birds, is something that's near and dear to my heart. I'm not an expert by any means, but what I had to say was basically I wanted to draw a parallel between something that I experienced when I was growing up home in Kenya with the rhino project and the elephants. As you know, elephants at some point, and rhinos even now, are on that endangered list. Obviously not as close as obviously not as bad as the tigers are, but there was a significant impact in the late 80s to the early 90s on the ban on ivory, where the Kenyan government got involved with a public burning of almost 3 tons of ivory, and there was what ensued after that was a ban on ivory, and countries followed suit. I know you the person right before I got on the line said that it is illegal to sell tiger products, but I wanted to draw a parallel in the government involvement of to the conservation effort.
Sure, to the black rhinos. Is there a parallel there, Herb?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And all of these, whether it's rhinos, whether horn, whether it's elephant tusks, whether it's tiger parts, it all has to do with this tremendous demand. And then the demand's going up. Where those demands are from, they're not from necessarily the same places for each, but they're going up. So how do you drive it down?
All right. And finally, to Maslin, Ohio. Veronica, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, everyone. I just wanted to have your guest, Diane, respond to an unusual circumstance that happens in Maslin, Ohio, where I live. I'll paraphrase it by first saying that I don't think the people of Maslin are bad people, but I don't think they understand what they're doing is necessarily appropriate, the best thing that they're doing for tigers. What it is, the Maslin football team gets a new tiger, about 1 to 2, sometimes 3 tiger cubs a year, because they want to have a tame tiger cub at each of their football games, because they name it Obi, and Obi is their mascot.
And what happens at the end of the season? what happens when the cub grows.
Yes, that's a big, big issue.
But what happens? Tell us.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you. Locally, they purchase the tigers. In the past 20 years, they've purchased 42 tiger cubs, and from the Stump Hill Farm, which is a place that sells and breeds exotic animals.
Veronica, we're almost out of time.
Oh, and that place, actually, I believe many of the tigers wind up spending their life in a cage at Stump Hill Farm.
All right, Alan, can you talk about this very briefly?
Well, those are tigers which come from captivity and they go back into captivity. That overall, from a very hard point of view, that does not affect what's happening in the wild world. What bothers me more is that these people who use tigers give nothing to try to be saving the wild animal, which they're using for their own purposes.
Please go to drshow.org. You will see photographs. You will see Caroline's article. drshow.org if you want to help save the tiger. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.